Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to meet two attorneys from here in Marin County, California, who just returned from 3 or 4 days at Standing Rock, North Dakota. Ford Green and Larry Bragman have a lot to tell you about the scene they observed, the dedication to peaceful resistance by the Native Americans and their supporters, the water protectors. And Larry Bragman has discovered some interesting legal theories about the mineral rights that are held by the tribes that could protect their interests in blocking the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. I think you'll find this very informative, and this podcast is made possible by great people like Paul Elsesser and Mark Lewis, very generous subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast. I invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com, click menu. When it pulls down, you click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page, and it's pretty simple from there. Thanks to everyone who listens and supports my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. The water protector demonstrations continue at Standing Rock, North Dakota, and I've got two gentlemen who've just returned from the scene.
If you really want to know what this wall is all about, take it from this coon, hey, there really ain't no doubt. Gonna say what's in my heart, that's my voice of manly right. I got a half a mind to talk all day and night about black gold politicians sell our soul. But taste of that black gold, how can it be so cold?
Dr. John opens our podcast today with a tune called Black Gold, Politicians Sell Our Souls. And that's the fundamental of what's going on in North Dakota these days. Ford Green is no stranger to the Peter B. Collins Show. He's been with me many times to talk about cults, including Scientology. Ford, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back, and good choice of music.
Okay, I'm glad you like it. Ford is also the mayor of San Anselmo, California, and he visited Standing Rock just a few days ago, along with Larry Bragman, who is in the studio. Both of these gentlemen are attorneys, and Larry is an actual water protector. He is an elected trustee or board member of the Marin County Municipal Water District. He previously served on the town council in Fairfax, California. And Larry, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Peter.
So you're both inside, and I see, Ford, you have three layers and a leather coat. And Larry, you kept your jacket on.
I have my smart wool, too.
You've been back for, what, 3 or 4 days? But it's really cold out there,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you didn't get the water cannon total treatment, I take it?
No, we were very lucky in that regard, or maybe we were just wimpy. But there was no direct action that we were involved in.
Mm-hmm. So for listeners who have just seen clips on TV and read accounts of this, what does it take to get to Standing Rock? You fly to Bismarck, right?
Fly to Bismarck, Denver, Bismarck, probably about a 2-hour drive out of Bismarck to the reservation and down a lonely road, and you're there at the camp and the encampment right along the Cannonball River.
Now, one of the descriptions I've heard, we've seen this bridge that has been a scene of confrontation, the water cannon incident on, I think, the 27th of November I referred to. And that has been blocked strategically by law enforcement. They left some burned out vehicles there. And this is a point of contention because it adds another 30 minutes, I'm told, to the drive around to get to the encampment.
Not only that, it's a public roadway. And it's completely unnecessary for law enforcement to have it blocked. And it is when we were there, we observed, a large semi-truck in addition to the water cannon vehicle, which I've heard a veteran describe as a vehicle that he drove, I think, in Iraq. So it's a jacked up, weaponized blockade of a public freeway that impedes access for food, impedes access for emergency vehicles, so that when there is law enforcement violence and abuse, as there has been down there, people have to go the long way around to go to the hospital.
Right, and this creates a potentially desperate situation for someone who is wounded in a confrontation with law enforcement agencies. And it's not just the, I guess Morton County is the scene there. It's right. Not just the sheriff's department. There are law enforcement officers from nine different states there. And Larry, what did you observe in terms of their ability to coordinate all this and who's actually in charge?
Well, it's a good question as to who's actually in charge, because I don't know if anybody is, because in addition to public safety, there's private security firms, and who knows who's really, you know, calling the shots. Ostensibly, I think Governor Dalrymple is in charge, although he is a lame duck who's on his way out. There's been, you know, a successor appointed, or rather elected. It is, and ostensibly he is in charge. He's been issuing an executive orders, including one last week or this week, actually, indicating, threatening arrest and fines for anybody that brings in fuel, food, or supplies to the camp.
Now, that's interesting, because the declaration that I heard the governor signed and then said he would not immediately enforce was to close the site out of the interests of the safety of the protesters.
While at the same time...
That was the first order, was an evacuation order for public safety, allegedly, because he was concerned about people being too cold. But as the tribe responded, they've been living in that cold for millennia, and while they appreciated the concern of a relative newcomer, they didn't really need his advice.
Well, the Corps of Engineers made the same citation, that it's out of, you know, the
concern.
Excessive concern for the protesters that they were ordering the camp closed. But, of course, we know that the pipeline company is very close to completion. And they really apparently just need maybe a few weeks of unobstructed activity to complete this pipeline under the Missouri River.
Correct. And under Lake Oahe, which is a reservoir for the tribe, along with, I'm sure, a lot of the other surrounding communities. It is a very large reservoir.
So as you see this situation, you know, I don't think any of us really have any dispute with the Native Americans or the American citizens who have joined them in this confrontation. But when you're there on the ground, does it feel any different? Do you have a stronger sense of the Native American connection to this ground and to their claims that it's sacred ground? What did you pick up from your personal experience there? Larry, you first.
Yeah, I'll go first, and Ford will jump in, because I'm sure we both felt the same thing. It's not being at a confrontation. It's really sanctified ground that is being protected for religious purposes, along with cultural recovery, community recovery, and really what the tribe is really trying to do is organize the encampment around those principles, recognizing the humanity of everybody that's there, including law enforcement, and really trying to avoid any kind of violence or any kind of violent confrontation.
Mm-hmm. And what vibe do you pick up, Ford?
I agree with Larry. What I would add to it is that there is a profound sense of what is best in human beings, what's best in humanity. The elders have a meeting almost every day at 1 o'clock in a large dome. And there they set down the ethic, I would say, for Standing Rock. And that ethic is one of learning how to unify. And when I first heard that word, you know, you hear pat terms all the time, and so it sort of had that ring, but not really. And when they went on to describe what they were talking about, it made a lot of sense, and I understood the ethic of nonviolence. And what they were talking about was really connecting among people there. And in order to do so, recognizing that just about everybody there came from a traumatic background, came from a dysfunctional family. And acknowledging that and taking responsibility for one's own trauma in order to get over yourself and get it out of the way so that then you could connect with other people. So that was part of it. And then another part of it was that is learning how to be quiet enough and receptive enough in oneself to be sensitive to and try to listen to the direction that was being given by the ancestors, by tribe members who had passed and who were really guiding a lot of what was going on there. And one example that was given was there was apparently a young guy who had come to Standing Rock with the intention of immolating himself on the front lines with gasoline. And the tribe went, no, that's not what we want. That's not what we're about. One, because of the violence, and two, because if there is violence, the cops have got all the firepower. And because they have the firepower, they're going to win. And that's not what the battle's about. The battle is about spirit and commitment on the tribe side versus the physical violence and repression that the government, state, and the cops are bringing on the other. And that was something that really came through increasingly for me while I was there.
And when we look at the efforts to confront the climate crisis and to engage our political machinery around it against the very powerful moneyed interests, the people who've been profiting from black gold for over 100 years, I think about the attempt to use the Keystone XL pipeline as kind of the icon and the pivot point to offer President Obama that opportunity to really show his commitment to the rhetoric that he has served up. And I thought Keystone was overplayed and that Obama was able to drag it out. And there wasn't this same connection to the earth and to a sense of spirituality. And so I see Standing Rock as perhaps, and unfortunately Obama is ignoring it, and he is a lame duck who I think will continue to ignore it, and we can't expect anything better from the succeeding administration. But in terms of electrifying the public and energizing action to confront carbon emissions and human contributed climate change, I do see this as something that runs much deeper than Bill McKibben's efforts, which, you know, I support and applaud, to use the Keystone for the same purpose. Ford?
There's something that rings true about that. There's an organicity, a spiritual organicity that I think, runs from the relationship of First Peoples to the land that they've lived on and off of for millennia. The wholesale betrayal and violations of trust from white government people of First Peoples, of Native Americans. And I think that's what resonates, because as Cornel West said recently on a Democracy Now! Interview, America's got two original sins. One is the genocide of the Indians, and the other is the enslavement of black people. And the genocide of Indians in white culture, I think, is largely disregarded and largely overlooked, but still very, very present. And there's something about this pipeline and the perniciousness of what it represents in terms of the connection that it will have to increasing climate change and increasing global warming and continuing along the path that we absolutely have to move our ship of state from heading in towards renewables that resonates. Mm-hmm. And that may have something to do with it, because it's just more real. This is their land, and it's their place, and it's their water. And yet again, in a geographic location where over history from 1851 to 1924 to 1934, there's been betrayal after betrayal after betrayal. And they're saying, enough already, and doing it by prayer and by commitment, looking at down the face of a water cannon, shooting water that's contaminated with something that was making a lot of people sick there, and simply saying no.
So the other thing, you know, it's like Ford said, and it, you know, to me it is the cauldron, the confrontation of technology and this, you know, self-destructive environmental path we're on, just attempting just to grind and roll over indigenous culture, which has been going on and is going on all over the world, because that's where a lot of the minerals are in these remote areas controlled by indigenous peoples. And people, you know, generally on the coasts and in the cities think it's history, but it's not. And especially out in an area like North Dakota, where you not only have the clash of culture, you have an economic clash. I mean, the Bakken oil field is a boom, a boon economically, short term,
right,
for the people of that area.
Well, the bubble has burst, right?
It certainly has. Mm-hmm. I mean, OPEC is working overtime feverishly to try to bolster the price of oil, and that remains to be seen. But you know, to a select group of people in the community and the investor class that's backing this thing, this is big bucks. This is big money. Warren Buffett is a major investor in this pipeline.
Well, and his railroad, BNSF, profits from hauling the product around and the supplies that are used in the fracking and other extraction. Donald Trump is invested at least $500,000 in this project. Kelsey Warren, who has kind of a schizophrenic image because he's a fracker and an oil baron at the same time, supports a lot of folk music performers in Texas. And to their credit, Charlie Pierce and others have rallied to confront him.
As did Jackson Browne. Jackson Browne has been a big recipient of his largesse. And he and Bonnie Raitt flew into Standing Rock, you know, during very harsh conditions to do a fundraiser at the casino when me and Ford were working at the casino at the meeting room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we missed the concert because we were being good, committed boys doing trying to do good theory, and I think we did good theoretical legal work for the tribe based on an idea that really was Larry's Larry's brilliance.
Well, I want to get to that in a moment. First, I want to talk about some of the legal issues related to those who have been arrested. We know that many of them have been overcharged. Many of them have been tricked into not being given legal counsel through public defenders. The paperwork wasn't properly filled out and things like that. We've seen Amy Goodman charged, a journalist who was obviously working there. Just today, we heard about a Canadian photojournalist who had been sent to Standing Rock by the CBC and was denied entry to the U.S. when he tried to fly out of Vancouver, and they seized his phones. He's not even an American citizen, and they treated him in this manner. And so there is a very concerted and orchestrated effort to downplay the situation, to prevent coverage, to brush back journalists and independent media people. And there's a guy, Kevin, who was live streaming this. And a week ago Sunday.
The bearded guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Australian accent.
Right.
Anyway, I give a lot of credit to these scrappy indie media people because on a Sunday night, the corporate networks are all, you know, playing reruns and Trump tweets and don't bother to give you any breaking news coverage. Talk a little bit about the legal confrontation that those who have gone to stand with the water protectors have faced.
There is an organized legal defense team on site called the Water Protector Legal Collective, and that was really our entry card into the camp. We contacted them ahead of time, sent them an application to help, and we met up with them at the camp. But there's a lot of confusion, and there's a lot of hardship just getting to and from court. A lot of the campers, demonstrators, guests of the tribe are there for short stints, and court dates can be put off 30 days, 45 days. So it creates a lot of hardship as far as travel to and from court, making long distance arrangements to get counsel. I just got an email from somebody in Hawaii who had sponsored three young people to go to Standing Rock and find out what was going on, just, you know, educational kind of experience. And they're scrambling for legal assistance.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that the collective is doing great work. And, you know, they're there on the ground at Standing Rock and, you know, really doing yeoman's work as mm-hmm. far as helping some of the demonstrators.
Well, it's really
now,
triage.
Now, Ford, you do some criminal defense work. You're a trial attorney. What did you see there?
Well, what I saw at the legal tent was triage, and triage in two senses. There was criminal defense triage, and there was accumulating information for people who had been injured by the cops using excessive force. And in terms of the people who are doing the criminal defense, I mean, if you have one demonstration and 100 people hauled in from that demonstration, if it were here in Marin, I think both Larry and I represented people who were involved in the Redwood Summer a couple decades ago,
mm-hmm.
Which involved the protests against Max Sam's clear-cutting of redwoods up on the North Coast.
And sure, Charles Hurwitz was the
Hurwitz,
lumber
right.
baron, yeah.
That's right, that's right. And there was a group of people that surreptitiously climbed up the Golden Gate Bridge and unfurled banners. And so we were involved in the representation of that. So each one of the people who were charged in that particular incident got separate lawyers. And at least theoretically, that's what ought to be happening in Bismarck.
Mm-hmm.
And I doubt if there are enough attorneys to be able to do that. And there's been also news reports that the jail facilities have not been adequate to process people. So instead, they're housed in animal kennels and are with inmate numbers written on their skin. And so at that point, I mean, I've heard an interview this morning on this morning's radio of the daughter of some Japanese internees in World War II. And it sounded just like the really similar. Is it human beings, that the disparity in power between the government and the people is in high relief there. And
do you believe that this what you're describing and the militarized response are adequately portrayed in the corporate media coverage?
Of course not. I mean, just in the last couple of days, CNN's gotten its butt down there and are doing some reporting, which is great. And, you know, it's about fucking time. Better late than never. But no, it's softened up. It's downplay. I mean, my God, I saw there was a release from the Morton County Sheriff's Office of two female officers talking about how they had been abused and how they'd been verbally abused and how they had had snowballs thrown at them. And it was so patently staged in terms of pandering to stereotypes and pandering to public opinion. And unfortunately, in a lot of our country, I mean, not so much here in our wonderful bubble of California and Marin County in particular, where a lot of people are pretty savvy and pretty intelligent and well-informed, there are a lot of people in our country that aren't that educated and aren't that well-informed and who buy that kind of crap. Mm-hmm. And it's really disturbing when, instead of fulfilling its function of acting as the fourth estate and providing accurate information to the populace of this country, who we're all given the responsibility and the blessing of choice and political power, but you need accurate information to be able to exercise it, and it has not been coming out mm-hmm. of Standing Rock.
Now, Larry Bragman, help us understand a little bit about the background of the treaties and any contracts that have been let that impact this pipeline, because you did some legal research and have some interesting theories about what you call the subjacent rights.
Right.
But before we get to that, give us a quick overview of the history of this land and the competing claims that are being presented right now.
So where Standing Rock is, it is a remnant of the Sioux Nation, and which were called – the Sioux is sort of a French bastardization. These tribes are the Lakota, are the Western, and Dakota are the Eastern halves of the tribe. And they inhabited a vast swath of land, of territory between the Cheyenne River in the northwest and the Missouri River in the southeast. And they were a very powerful group of hunter tribes, buffalo hunting tribes, horsemen, warriors, one of the most powerful tribes in North America. And in 1851, Red Cloud settled by treaty of 1851 at Fort Laramie, setting the boundaries for the Sioux territory. And that encompassed that whole area from the Cheyenne River all the way down to the Missouri River, huge swath of grasslands in north central United States. That began to erode when gold was discovered in the Black Hills. And, you know, under the 1851 treaty, the Black Hills were given to the tribe forever. But when gold was discovered, that forever was forgotten. And in 1868, a new treaty was forced down the tribe's throat. That also was actually a beneficial treaty. As you look at all these treaties, that was kind of a win for the tribe. But over the course of the last 150 years, bit by bit, the tribe lost more and more of its territory. Economic hardship caused the tribe to sell property. They were cheated out of land, out of minerals. 1924, Congress passed the Indian Citizenship Act, which really put a legal termination on the tribe's legal claims of sovereignty, national sovereignty. 1934, a further effort to further reduce the legal standing of the tribe as a sovereign nation. And, you know, disbursement efforts, cultural attempts to repress the culture and language followed for the next 50 years to where by the 1960s, a lot of Indian people were encouraged to move off the reservation, go to Bureau of Indian Affairs schools. And there was just it was just a cultural genocide and a politicide, because not only was the culture attacked, but the economic and political base of the tribe's existence was attacked. And that finally gave rise to the American Indian Movement, which came to a head in 1973 at Wounded Knee, which is pretty close to where we were. And a lot of the Wounded Knee volunteers were from Standing Rock, including Russell Means. So
I met Russell Means and Dennis Banks in Gresham, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. in about 1973.
For the Menominee Indians,
yes,
right?
Yes, they hold up in a monastery there a winter.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So that was sort of the culminate. That was sort of the flashpoint. And, you know, a lot of violence. A lot of violence from... tribal government that really was what did you call it for? Like it was a terror state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a goon squad.
Goon squad.
Well, and Leonard Peltier, a political prisoner, remains incarcerated in the United States.
Remains.
Yeah. Is that Obama should pardon?
Yes, he should.
So that all being said and done, that's sort of the big background on this particular issue with the Standing Rock and the Water Protectors. The Lake Oahe, which remains the critical link for the pipeline, is a reservoir that was created by the construction of Oahe Dam by the Bureau of Reclamation, the Army Corps of Engineers. In doing that project in 1948, they flooded 56,000 acres of prime ranch land of the Standing Rock Reservation and did not compensate the tribe. It took the tribe 10 years to get a bill for compensation through Congress, which is the bill Ford mentioned, Public Law 85915. And so just to kind of bring it in a nutshell, as we were walking around the camp, I mentioned to Ford, gee, I wonder if they got subjacent rights. Because they certainly got rights they got surface water rights, the Army Corps did and the government did, to flood the surface. But the question remains under property law about what's called subjacent, or essentially what are the underground rights, the mm-hmm. mineral rights. Mm-hmm. And that just was – it just occurred to me, you know, that would be something that we need to check out. And in talking to Phyllis Young, who became our contact with the tribe, I asked her about it. And she said, oh, no. We reserved our mineral rights. And it was at that point that Ford and I, you know, got organized to go to the meeting room at the casino and start doing some legal research with the limited resources we had. And Phyllis had kind of an old dog-eared copy of this congressional bill that was passed in 1958.
Just let me interrupt for a minute, because I was the one that – I mean, it was awesome. Because Larry had this, we were walking around just basically surveying the territory of the camp so that we would know, you know, what was what and where everything was. Larry comes up with this really smart idea, and I go, wow. And then we meet Phyllis. Well, first, then there's the elders meeting. Phyllis was a talker, and afterwards we introduce ourselves, and she invites us to go to the casino. We get up to the casino, and she Larry immediately is like on a computer doing independent research, and Phyllis passes me this 85915, and I start reading it, and it dovetailed very, very well with Larry's theory. And so I started to work at extracting the relevant points out of that, and go ahead on.
So if the tribe
and it's specifically and unambiguously reserves all mineral rights whatsoever to the tribe,
and that's the language whatsoever.
And that it's explicit in the legislation. So it's not a treaty from 1851. It's not a judicial decision that was handed down by a judge. It is an act of Congress that is seemingly been ignored, and that act of Congress was later reaffirmed in 1992 when Congress passed another compensation act, when it realized that I think the total of $6 million for 56,000 acres might have been inadequate compensation. So there was supplemental compensation given, which reaffirmed all rights and reservations that the tribe had. And
then in 2012, there was subsequent litigation against Salazar by the tribe, which again reiterated that reservation of oil, gas, and all mineral rights whatsoever.
But help me understand. I see that as a significant asset to the tribes and a benefit under the law and the preceding treaties. But can we equate a pipeline route with mineral rights?
I think so.
And I think we can.
That's about where I was going to go, because it's like freedom of religion. It's like the free exercise of religion. The free exercise of religion includes the right to say, no, I don't want any religion at all. And so mineral rights are the same thing. Just because you have mineral rights is not any compulsion to extract them. You also have the choice to say, leave it the fuck alone. And I think that's what the tribe has, is the leave it the fuck alone. And that right of theirs that's been repeatedly codified is being wholesalely violated by both the Army Corps and Energy Transfer Partnership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it is a bit of a unique situation, because it is an artificial man-made reservoir. Mm-hmm. So it's not a navigable river. There's a whole different set of law for navigable rivers in North Dakota. But this was an instance in which the government took 56,000 acres. So the government never had clear title to the land. And when Congress finally acted, it specifically reserved all mineral rights to the tribe. So mm-hmm. it's a little bit different than if the government actually ever bought the land. It never did. It has the right to operate the Owyhee Lake Reservoir. It has the right to regulate drilling and other activities that might interfere with the reservoir. But it doesn't own the subjacent rights. Those rights have always remained with the tribe.
Now, Larry, one of the things that's just surfaced recently, and I think it came from an interview with Kelsey Warren, is that the original route was to bring it to much closer to Bismarck. And it was determined that, well, there's a population center and there could be a leak in this pipeline, and therefore that's too risky. So the risk was shifted downriver
to the tribe.
Is there any legal agreement, even one that may have been inappropriately engaged in, that gives Energy Transfer Partners any easement or other right to build this pipeline? Or is that held by the Corps? Or does it not exist and it's just being...
I think it's held by the tribe.
And it is held by the tribe. The Corps can give it, has certain rights, authority around Lake Owyhee. It can regulate activity around the reservoir to make sure it doesn't conflict with their operation of the reservoir. You know, that all being said, yeah, they went through this truncated environmental review process, which completely circumvented the intent of the environmental protection laws of this country. What I heard in a lecture from Robert Kennedy Jr. was that what they did is they segmented the project. This is about a 1,700-mile project. Under the Clean Water Act, there are exemptions for what are called small projects, like maybe under an acre. So this is like when a farmer wants to dig a ditch or something like that on a wetland. And so what Energy Transfer Partners did is they segmented this 1,700-mile gargantuan project into hundreds of small projects to avoid environmental assessment. And the tribe hired an expert to do a critique of the environmental assessment that was done by the Army Corps. And it was done actually by an expert who normally works for the Army Corps of Engineers. Mm. And, you know, there's about a 12-page report that's available online that is a very clear and sharp critique of the whole pipeline project, starting with the theory that, well, we can detect any leak in this pipeline. And he goes through a whole explanation of that. That technology is not foolproof. It's not instantaneous. The pipeline is going to be carrying something upwards of 500 to 600,000 barrels of oil a day. That's about a million barrels an hour.
Well, and this crude oil that comes from shale deposits has to be pumped through at high temperatures so that it's nearly liquid and at a very high pressure point. These pipelines run at 1,800 to 2,000 pounds per square inch. And so a bad weld, a pinhole puncture could easily produce a very big spill.
Not to mention corrosion over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very quick. And, you know, and you go from there, from leak detection. If this thing leaks for an hour, that's a million gallons. 2 hours, 2 million, and so on. You know, the whole thing about pipe quality, they use an X-ray technology. That's not foolproof. And, you know, we know from PG&E and other incidents of, you know, pipeline failure that it happens. Welds fail.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very...
And human beings don't pay attention.
Right.
Human beings fall asleep at the switch.
Yeah, once a pipeline is buried, it's forgotten.
Correct.
Often.
Correct. There will be electronic sensors every whatever, few hundred feet, whatever it is, but... It is not foolproof. It is not instantaneous. The territory it's going through is prone to rock slides.
Mm-hmm.
This is brought out in the environmental assessment. You don't put pipes through landslide prone areas because, you know, if a boulder hits the pipe isn't designed to take that kind of force.
Right.
It's going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the whole environmental review process was circumvented. The tribe's property rights have been ignored. The Historic Preservation Act has been ignored. I mean, where Standing Rock is considered a holy site for the Standing Rock and Sioux Nation. It's the confluence of the Cannonball and Missouri River. And I was reading one of the pleadings. There are special, very profoundly round rocks that are formed by the confluence of those two rivers, which are considered sacred rocks.
Mm-hmm.
That's been completely ignored. Energy Transfer Partners bulldozed an area of graveyards and other sacraments that was not even reported. So there's just been, complete disregard
mm-hmm.
for the rights and dignity of the tribe in this project.
I don't have anything to add.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, as we wrap up here, how do you see this going forward? We have 2,000 Veterans for Peace who are deploying at Standing Rock this week. We have the orders to evacuate from the Corps and from the governor. And so it does appear that there will be some sort of further showdown in the relatively near future. That said, if Trump is inaugurated, and I'm having to accept this more and more every day, that's going to be a very difficult challenge because he doesn't really have a high regard for legal process and the Constitution.
And he's an investor he's an investor in the project too.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But again, president
has no conflict.
President has no conflict. President can commit no crimes, right?
Yeah. Well, Nixon said that, right?
Yeah.
Well, he said, I'm not a crook. I think that the state is backing off of their evacuation order and they're backing off of their blockade order. But that's the state. And what really needs to happen now is for Obama to get brave and Obama to change his behavior so that it does match the loftiness of his rhetoric, and that he does something really, really courageous, because I think everybody that voted for him has been waiting for that. And killing the XL pipeline was great. He needs to do that again, and he needs to do it now. And if it were to be undone by Trump, then we'll deal with that when it happens. But in the meantime, he needs to grow some and take some action.
Larry, what's your sense?
My sense is the tribe is doing everything it can do to avoid a confrontation and wage a battle of moral authority. And I don't think there's any two groups that have more moral authority in our culture than Native Americans and veterans. Just quick little anecdote. While we were there sort of checking out another militarized area across the Cannonball River, there are surveillance lights strung along the pipeline that Ford and I looked at from our camp every night. And we hiked sort of through a wetland to get a little closer and see what was going on. And that was somewhat barricaded by concertina wire, and that's where a lot of law enforcement was. And a group of us sort of started to congregate there. And you could see on the other side that sort of caused consternation and, you know, attention and tension. And when that happened, there was a group of about four or five young Indian guys that came riding up on horseback, sort of delivering the message, stand back, stand down. And, you know, that image will stay with me. And I think that's sort of that's the vibe, that's the message that the tribe is banking on, that their moral authority and historical authority will prevail.
Thanks for briefing us, Larry Bragman, Ford Green, and thanks for standing with the water protectors at Standing Rock.
Thanks. My honor.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth conversation with attorneys Ford Green and Larry Bragman about Standing Rock. Your comments are welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.